Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jenna Yauk Erickson. I am an assistant state public defender here this morning representing the appellant, Mr. Lee Bolton. Mr. Bolton has raised two interrelated evidentiary issues for this court's consideration. The first, that the district court erred by admitting testimony about Mr. Bolton's prior acts that did not qualify under the relationship evidence statute. The second, that the district court erred by admitting criminal complaints as exhibits in Mr. Bolton's trial.
Counsel, it's my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that the testimony and the complaints both came in under the guise of 63420. Is that correct?
I believe that's true, Your Honor. Certainly the state...
The question I have is, if this court were to conclude that none of the evidence qualified under 63420, which the state seems to concede in its brief, is there any reason for the court to separately look at the complaints to determine whether they violated hearsay, confrontation clause, Rule 609, and Rule 404?
You certainly don't need to, Your Honor.
I just want to make sure I understand why those complaints were admitted. And as best I can tell, they were offered to prove up the prior domestic or alleged domestic incidents under 63420.
Yes, I appreciate the question. They certainly did both come in. The testimony and the exhibits were introduced through the same witness. When the state moved pretrial for the admission of the evidence, they used the relationship evidence statute as their grounds for admission. There was no argument, to my recollection, of any different legal grounds for the complaints. So certainly this court could conclude they all fall under the same legal argument, the same legal error argument, which is the statute, and that was plainly erroneous.
Thank you.
I will turn to prejudice because I believe that's the main issue for this court's consideration given the state's concession.
Let me ask you one question before you get to that, and maybe it gets to your ultimate argument on prejudice. But, of course, Mr. Bolton was pro se here, and the record seems to indicate that he agreed that both the 63420 and complaint evidence could come in. So my question is, in the context of a plain error analysis, is there a difference between waiving by failing to object, which really doesn't affect the plain error analysis, compared to affirmatively agreeing, yeah, all that evidence can come in?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, so why not? I mean, and the reason I ask is it's in the context of the trial court judge who's sitting there presiding over this proceeding, has a party telling her, I think it was her in this case, no problem, Judge. I want that to come in. That's part of my trial strategy, basically.
Well, he didn't say it was part of his trial
strategy.
No, he didn't.
I agree, but how did the judge know why he wanted it in or not? From the standpoint of the trial court judge, it's not like someone just failed to object. This is someone telling her in the courtroom, fine, I don't care.
Certainly, Your Honor. A few responses.
Yeah.
First, if you deem that Mr. Bolton acting pro se by saying they can have that acquiesce to the state's erroneous admission of this evidence, that's invited error. That's what respondent is arguing. All that means is that you apply the plain error standard. It's very clear in the case law. Interestingly enough, that's mostly the same as harmless error, especially here where the state has conceded error, right? Conceded error that is plain. The Matthews case cited in my reply brief says the prejudice standard for harmless error and plain error, identical. This court's consideration is the same. So the added prong that you have is the fourth one under Griller, that it has to be in the interests of fairness and justice to grant Mr. Bolton a new trial. I think certainly that is the case here. And the sort of the flip side to the coin of Your Honor's question is the district court was presented with a motion or a responsive paper from defense counsel when Mr. Bolton still had counsel that said in no uncertain terms, this evidence is inadmissible. The same cases that I cite here. It used all caps and bold and underlined. It was quite emphatic. The court was well aware that this evidence was inadmissible, and it's the court's duty to be the gatekeeper. So I can't think of an exact parallel, but something that is so black and white as this, like sentencing. Say a defendant, pro se at sentencing, says, yeah, I think I have those criminal history points. You can use them. If they're not valid under the sentencing guidelines, it's the court's duty to say, oh, actually, those are incorrect. We can't use those in your sentence. So at most, Mr. Bolton acquiesced this error. He did. He stood there by himself.
That might be a little bit different with criminal history points. I mean, that has a sentencing impact.
Sure.
We always look at sentences.
I tried to think of an example that I believe is equally black and white as this issue, which as not only the state's concession, but in this court's case law, the statute, it's just very clear this was not admissible. But I would say at most, Your Honor, you apply plain error.
Counsel, I think you've accurately stated the interplay between invited error and plain error. Even if we were to conclude that this is invited error, and it's not entirely clear to me under the case law it is, but even if we were to conclude that, we do plain error analysis. And sort of the point in that analysis in which we could take into account, oh, we've got a district court judge here being told, I want this evidence to come in, does that seemingly come in the last factor? In other words, if you had a case where the defendant said, nope, I want that evidence in, and then at trial somehow used that evidence to buttress his defense and then complained, we might say, and we have said, we're not going to let you try a case based on evidence you agreed to and then complain that it was admitted. But that could be different from a case where someone just says, fine, they can have it in, and then doesn't use that evidence at all. It just harms him.
I think
is that where we get to the concern about what's a district court judge supposed to do when a defendant is saying, let it in?
I think, yes, this court could consider under the fourth prong of Griller. I don't actually think invited error applies here, but even if it does, you know, if you're at that fourth prong, you could consider, among all the other factors, that Mr. Bolton, I don't even know that it's fair to say he wanted it admitted. He said, sure. He said, that's fine. They're having discussions about evidence. I think the prosecutor did some things that helped Mr. Bolton, right, stipulating to evidence. So it was a bit of equality, right? Sure, they can have that. That is at most what we have. There's a lot of other reasons that it would be in the interests of fairness and justice to give him a new trial.
Let me ask you this on the prejudice factors. I'm having a hard time applying the first two. The first one is whether there was other admissible evidence on the issue. As I understand that factor, it seems to presume that there is an issue for which there could have been some relevant evidence, and there was other evidence that was admissible on this issue. But in this case, I'm failing to see what the issue is for which any other evidence would have been admissible. It doesn't seem to me that factor fits. Am I wrong in having that concern?
It's a bit of an odd fit, Your Honor. I think typically where you see this is some evidence was erroneously admitted. That much is clear. But the state got it in a different way, right? A totally different mechanism.
On something that is a relevant issue in the trial.
Sure.
So here, what would be the relevant issue established by his prior history?
That's part of the oddity of this case, is that the entirety of this evidence is irrelevant. It should have never come in. Sort of a different way to conceptualize that first factor, and some of the other, you know, there's various factor tests in the court's case law.
One way to say it is this factor doesn't really fit here because we can't identify an issue for which any evidence would have been admissible.
Yes, and then I would say that would weigh in Mr. Bolton's favor.
The second factor, I have the same question because it's the lack of a curative instruction. And generally, we want a curative instruction to explain to the jury, here's what you may consider this evidence for and may not consider the evidence for. If we're looking at a case where everybody agrees none of this evidence should have come in, well, what curative instruction could there have been? It's not a case where, okay, the evidence came in, but we didn't tell the jury how to limit it. If the evidence wasn't supposed to come in, what curative instruction would there be? There is no proper purpose.
To be sure. I would assert if we're going to consider that both of those first two factors are a bit of an odd fit, they should nonetheless weigh in Bolton's favor. So what we know post-Zinsky is that district courts now have to sua sponte give a cautionary instruction on relationship evidence. So you have to put yourself in the mind frame of the trial. Now we're looking back, right? Hindsight is 20/20. At the time, everyone agreed this was relationship evidence, and it was coming in. It is the district court's duty to then give that cautionary instruction.
So there need to be an objection, though, to put that responsibility on the district court?
Not after Zinsky.
What does Zinsky say? I saw Zinsky in your brief, and I read it, and I did not think it applied here.
Well, Zinsky was in 2019. Mr. Bolton's trial was in 2018. What Zinsky says is if evidence is admitted under 634.20 going forward, so Zinsky's very clear, from the date of the opinion on.
Over the defendant's objection.
Well, sure. I mean.
Oh, and that's okay. Why I don't think so, it applies, because I thought what Zinsky said is if the state offers 634.20, the defendant objects, the court must sua sponte give a curative instruction unless the defendant objects to the curative instruction. Isn't that what the case says?
I think that is accurate.
If in this case he did not object, why would there, I don't think there's an obligation for the court to give the curative
It's not a standalone issue here, to be sure. But again, the jury's not told how they're supposed to use, the jury can't use the evidence at all, well, but
right,
they
so
hear
then why
it.
Why would you need a curative instruction?
Well, okay, so.
You can't have it both ways, and I'm agreeing with Judge Larkin on that. You can't say that it's mandated there be a curative instruction, but then don't give a curative instruction. I mean, what are you suggesting?
I'm not saying it's mandated that she give a curative instruction.
That was what you were reading into Zinsky.
Well, again, I didn't raise it as a standalone issue. Because the time Mr. Bolton's trial happened before Zinsky. So I wouldn't be able to argue that as an independent error. So let's back up a bit on prejudice.
Talk about the third and fourth factors, because those are relevant, and that's where we're going to be looking.
Absolutely. Let's keep in mind what the jury heard. So the jury hears both through Ms. Milton's testimony, through the exhibits that it has accessible in the jury room, and through the prosecutor's closing.
The exhibits being the complaints.
Exhibits being the complaints. That in 2006, Mr. Bolton hit Milton's sister's boyfriend in the head with a metal pole. In 2008, he threw a fan at his romantic partner. And in 2010, attacking a group of people, including children, he threw some sort of can at them, a can of beer, a can of pop. They're able to look at the complaints. The complaints list his entire criminal history that the jury should have never had accessible to it. The complaints list his custody status, which is inadmissible. The complaints list all sorts of prejudicial, irrelevant information like the extent of the victim's injuries, how belligerent and rude he was to the police officers, things that have no basis coming into this trial. And then you have a prosecutor walk the jury through each of these incidents and nearly explicitly use a propensity inference. He suggests to the jury that there is, quote, a commonality. Look at all of these bad things he does. He's a violent, intoxicated jerk. There's a commonality he did it again. None of that is acceptable. The state concedes here that the prosecutor violated the law and the district court didn't do anything to correct it. The prosecutor then exacerbates that during closing. Read pages 582 through 584 of the transcript. That's where it happens in closing. It is explicit, it is repeated, and it is not brief. This court sees cases all the time where lawyers raise issues of evidence being erroneously admitted, and it's not mentioned in closing, or it's very brief. It's one line, and it's easy for this court to say that was harmless. That didn't affect this jury. Keep in mind, the question here is whether it affected them, whether it affected their deliberations, their decision. They had to decide whether Mr. Bolton stabbed this person. You think they're really going to hear all of that information, inadmissible information about him, and not be affected by it? They certainly were. Again, because the prosecutor suggested to them rather explicitly, his character is at issue here. He's a bad guy. He's a violent guy.
Argues that the evidence was strong, so we should overlook the prejudice. Could you address that?
I can't.
State had three witnesses.
True, Your Honor. That's only one factor. I'm not going to stand here and suggest they didn't have sufficient evidence of Mr. Bolton's guilt. Nonetheless, this is not a sufficiency analysis. It's an effect analysis, an impact analysis. So cases like Caulfield and Juarez point out it's not a but-for test. The question is not whether the jury still would have convicted him. He gets a fair trial, just like everyone else.
Bolton raised that in his pro se briefs, the sufficiency argument.
He may have, Your Honor, and this court can consider that independently. My assertion is when you're looking at the prejudice from the admission of this evidence, it's not as simple as was there sufficient evidence of his guilt. You look at the impact.
He did not testify, correct?
He did not. No, he did call witnesses.
He called witnesses for an alibi defense.
Yes.
And are you suggesting that the prejudicial information about his history impacted the jury's assessment of his witnesses, his alibi defense?
Absolutely. Not only that, but it bolstered the state's witnesses. It bolstered Ms. Milton's credibility to hear all of these bad things that he had done to her in the past. It suggests she's telling the truth in this trial. But mostly, it swamped the jury. I don't know how.
His defense was alibi.
It was. And this came down to credibility, essentially. These three people said he was there. He's saying, I wasn't there at the time of the stabbing. I was there.
Couldn't be there.
Couldn't be there because I was home by 10, right? Which pro se, he was able to introduce evidence and call witnesses and try his best to establish that alibi defense. The jury, there's no way they considered that sort of thoroughly, properly, given all of this negative, inadmissible evidence about him. I see my time has expired.
You'll
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state. I'd point the court to pages 18 and 19 of the transcript, where it's cited on page 7 of my brief, where Mr. Bolton specifically says that he's going to be challenging the credibility, and it doesn't bother him if this information comes in. That's no problem because they're not credible. So I do think that he kind of did use it in a sense. He's accusing her of lying when he's cross-examining her. He does not ask her questions about it. I think that goes toward the prejudice. The state does concede that this was 6 degrees of separation of relationship evidence. There's no reason that this should have come in under 63420.
And the state also agrees that even if this was invited error, we still do a plain error analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe Benton says that.
And so do you agree that the reason for the admission of both the testimony and the complaints was 63420? So once we say none of this was 63420, the complaint shouldn't have been in either?
Yes, I would. I do think possibly that the complaints would have been coming in to determine whether he was a danger to public safety. Typically, that would have been done at a bifurcated
sentencing trial. That's not
yes.
part of the
and
guilt
it,
determination.
It was not used in that fashion. That could have been the reason for it, but it was admitted through 63420 in this instance.
Could you address then the prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to the prejudice, I would agree that it was mentioned in the closing argument, but here it is not an issue of prosecutorial error being raised. There is no challenge to that, even if there was a propensity argument that could have been made. Appellant has not raised that. The state also talked about the witnesses and the eyewitnesses. We have the victim who's testifying as to what happened to him. We have his girlfriend who's testifying to what she observed, and we also have the girlfriend's daughter. So there are three individuals who witnessed this.
How old is the daughter?
I am not sure. I believe she's an adult, but I'm...
Adult daughter, not...
I believe so. It's not the daughter in question between appellant and NM. It's a different daughter of NM's.
Was there... did he cross-examine those witnesses?
He cross-examined NM for sure, and he did not ask anything specific with regard to what happened. He went on and on about the alibi and how he was not there, and he accused NM of lying, of having sex with him and having ME walk in on them. He basically took a different tactic, and so it was more of a domestic relationship there.
Was there any evidence of drug or alcohol use by these people before the incident occurred?
Yes, Your Honor. Some of the individuals had been smoking marijuana, I believe. It's included in the facts section of my brief.
The victim, did he
admit? I believe the victim did as well. Yes, on page 2 of my brief, NM and ME, that would be the ex-girlfriend and the victim, ME, were playing dominoes and smoking marijuana at the dining room table while appellant was in the living room watching football. So that did come into evidence. So here, with regard to the prejudice prong, it's the state's position that, although it was erroneous for it to come in, the overwhelming weight of the evidence was strong here. Additionally, it does not affect the substantial fairness of the trial when the defendant agreed for it to come in. He does say it doesn't bother me, he's fine with it. And so this is, I would agree with Ms. Yelk-Erickson that this is not an instance where he actively sought it out. It's not like Benton where there's an act of seeking out of a courtroom closure and then challenging it later. It's not like that. However, the state believes that it is still invited error and it would still pass muster under the plain error doctrine.
Determining prejudice is hard to weigh. Appellant counsel is talking about, I mean, frankly, the 63420 information that came in, paints him as a badass. How do we know the jury can get away from that?
We don't. However, this was not an instance where he was arguing what he, if you look at the context of the trial, he's arguing he wasn't there.
Well, right.
So his character was not at issue as much as if someone was saying, I didn't have the ability to do this, this person was not injured. I wasn't there, it wasn't me.
But doesn't that sort of go in his favor? I mean, if I were looking at this and he had not presented an alibi defense, mm-hmm. and all this stuff comes in, it shouldn't have, it's very prejudicial. But we have three witnesses saying he was there, he did it, and he doesn't present any defense. then the evidence seems overwhelming. But now he presents an alibi defense, calls a witness, and presents a document that says he's present for bed check in St. Paul at 10 p.m. I mean, who knows whether the jury might have given more consideration to his alibi defense and come to the conclusion that the two marijuana users are not telling the truth had they not heard this ugly picture of his past.
I can see Your Honor's point, and I agree that it is dependent on the circumstances presented here. And in this instance, there was a strong alibi presented. He was home at 10 o'clock for bed check. He did challenge the investigator who testified with regard to the bus schedule and his ability to get back, and he put on a strong defense. However, the eyewitness testimony, the prior consistent statements, made the state's case overwhelming, which is the state's position that, therefore, prejudice is not established.
So, Ms. Lawn, my question kind of goes to the fourth prong of the plain error analysis, and that is, I mean, there's no dispute here that I'm hearing that there was plain error, and you just told us that it's hard to know what the prejudice was because of that. It seems to me, as ministers of justice, I mean, when do we reach the point where we as an appellate court should step in then? And say, you know, to protect the integrity of these proceedings, it's just not clear what the effect was here, and there should be a new trial. I mean, where do we draw that line? It seems to me like the evidentiary errors here were pretty significant and really unchallenged on appeal. Why hasn't this case crossed the line where, you know, to protect the integrity of the system, Mr. Bolton should have a new trial without this evidence?
It's the state's position that here it's not enough, in part because he agreed to the evidence coming in. And additionally, Judge Garcia did not sua sponte stop it, in a sense. If there was an issue with a line being crossed, perhaps the appropriate jurist to stop it would have been the district court here, especially with an individual who's acting pro se.
But isn't that the reason we would grant a new trial? I mean, we'd essentially be saying, we've all been there. We understand what it's like to try a case with a pro se defendant who is saying, yes, things can come in, but at some point when it's patently obvious that this evidence is inadmissible and it's patently obvious that it is very prejudicial, at some point the district court has an obligation to just exercise some independent judgment about limiting that evidence. And if it hasn't happened, is it wrong to think, well, that is the case where the interests of justice and maintaining the integrity of a trial requires a new trial? And in other words, just because we have a pro se defendant here who is going along with the flow doesn't mean you can railroad him.
And I would agree, Your Honor. It absolutely does not mean that he can be railroaded here. And I understand that in this instance, there's the benefit of all three of you having been trial judges, so you have this unique perspective. And here, perhaps this is that case. It is the state's position that it is not that case.
Understood. Thank you.
Unless there are further questions, I would respectfully ask you to affirm the district court, or excuse me, the conviction. Thank you.
As I've worked on this case, it has repeatedly struck me just how unusual it is. I have been in my job for 6 years. I've litigated roughly 150 appeals, all criminal, and I have never seen a prosecutor try to introduce criminal complaints in that prosecutor's case in chief in a jury trial, because prosecutors know they can't do that. Similarly, it is pretty unusual to see this extent of use of that inadmissible evidence in closing. I think sometimes prosecutors realize, oh, whoops, I shouldn't have done that, and then they don't mention it.
Prosecutorial misconduct is not a part of your theme today, right?
It's not.
Under the rules of evidence.
Yep, but that's still a part of the prejudice. Specific prong of prejudice is whether it was used in closing. And it was emphasized quite clearly. And this court's job is to determine whether there was prejudice, so whether there was the reasonable possibility that the wrongfully admitted evidence significantly affected the verdict. Certainly, we have these factor tests, and they're helpful. But I don't think this court should feel somehow limited by them. So some of the other factor tests suggest you consider whether it was highly persuasive, whether it was effectively countered by the defense, things like that. So I think you certainly can consider the nature of the evidence, that it was rather egregious. You can consider the quantity of the evidence, and you can consider that there was no remedy internal to the trial. You can't say that Mr. Bolton effectively countered this evidence. He didn't suggest to the jury, I didn't really do those crimes, or I've reformed myself, I'm a good guy, right? He didn't counter it at all. So those sorts of factors would also weigh in Mr. Bolton's favor. And I agree, Judge Larkin. I actually thought to myself, had this been a case where Mr. Bolton, pro se, did nothing, presented no defense, didn't cross-examine witnesses, put on no case, perhaps it would be accurate for this court to say the evidence was overwhelming. I don't think it gets to that point because he did put on a defense. And that defense has some meat to it. It's not a... He tried his best to put on this alibi defense and show I was in this place at this time, I couldn't have been in this place at that time. So for that reason, the evidence was not overwhelming. That factor also, at a minimum, it's neutral if it does not weigh in Mr. Bolton's favor. Due to the truly unusual nature of this case, the egregiousness of the errors, it is in the interest of fairness and justice to grant Mr. Bolton a new trial, and that's what we would ask this court to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you to both counsel. The matters are deemed submitted, and a decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. We're ahead of schedule.
Ahead? Look at us.
What's the time? Court will recess until the next cases are ready. I'll ask Mr. Huff if you'll just let us know when they're ready to proceed.
All right.
Hang on the seat.
Yes. Good morning.
Your mic order is splitting up, right?
Not on this first one. We are on the guardianship.
Oh, okay.
Minnesota Court of Appeals.